Croeso i Heb Asid, cyfres o bodlediadau gan archifau Gogledd Ddwyrain Cymru. Yma yn archifau Gogledd Ddwyrain Cymru, mae gennym filoedd o gofnodion hanesyddol sy'n cwmpasu bron 900 mlynedd o hanes yr ardal leol. Mae'r ddogfen gynharaf sydd gennym ar hyn o bryd yn dyddio 1138, a rydym yn casglu eu temau cyfredol hefyd. Ein gwaith ni yw nid yn unig edrych ar ôl y cofnodion hyn ar gyfer cenedlaethau'r dyfodol, ond hefyd ennyn diddordeb bobl yn rhyfetadaeth Gogledd Ddwyrain Cymru. Mae'r archifau'n llawn o straeon o'n bobl go iawn ac mae Heb Asid yn gyfres o straeon digidol o bodlediadau sy'n archwilio'r straeon hyn. Mae'r benod hon o Heb Asid yn canolbwyntio ar ddwy gyfrol clawr lletr ddiymhongar yr un casgliad sy'n cael ei galw'n Llyfrau Gweplin. Rhoddwyd y cyfrolau Victoriaid hyn i ni gan yr heddlu lleol. Maen nhw'n cynnwys ffotograffau y droseddwyr, ochr yn ochr a disgrifiadau corfforol a manylion am eu troseddau. Euogfarnwyd y rhan fwyaf o troseddwyr yn y cyfrolau yn Rhuthun, ond cafodd cyfran eu euogfarnu mewn mannau eraill hefyd. Rhoddwyd y cyfrolau at ei gilydd gan uwch arolygydd J. Bradshaw, a byddai'r heddlu wedi ei defnyddio i adnabod drwg weithredwyr oedd wedi dychwelyd i Ogledd Cymru. Ein gwestai ar gyfer y podlediad hwn yw Richard Island. Roedd Richard yn darlithio yn adran y gyfraith Prifysgol Aberystwyth am 20 mlynedd cyn iddo ymddeol yn arbenigo mewn hanes, trosedd a chos. Mae Richard wedi ysgrifennu llawer o erthyglau a nifer o lyfrau ar y pwnc, yn cynnwys Land of White Gloves, A History of Crime and Punishment in Wales. Mae e wedi bod ar y radio a'r teledu sawl gwaith, yn cynnwys ar The One Show, BBC 1, mewn darn wedi ffilmio yng Ngharcha Rhuthun yn trafod trosedd a ffotograffiaeth. Bydd Richard yn cael ei gyfweld gan ein swyddog ymgysylltiad cymunedol, Katie. Bydd y benod hon yn cael ei chyflwyno yn Saesneg, ond cadwch lygad am gynnwys Cymraeg gennym yn y dyfodol.
So, croeso, Richard, thank you. Diolch for joining us today. So, this is actually our first ever episode of Acid Free, so it's very exciting. And yeah, we'll be chatting about our collection of criminal description books and also exploring some of the individuals and what their lives might have been like as well. So I thought we could start off by talking about why were these albums created and what they would have been used for.
Diolch yn fawr iawn, Katie, and I'm hugely honoured to be your first podcast interviewee, and I'm very pleased to be talking about this subject as well, because you have these wonderful police books of photographs. So maybe I'll just give a little bit of context about why they're there and what they're intended to do. This is quite an involved story. I mean, first thing is photography is a new technology, and like all new technologies, there's high hopes for it. Some often high hopes in new technology for solving old problems like crime. There are a number of reasons why that issue of criminal identification becomes important from the middle of the 19th century, really, which is the period after that where your books come from. And that is that the society is changing a lot, obviously. There's greater social mobility and faster social mobility. People can get on a train and leave a place where they're known and travel for the first time in history faster than muscle, faster than gossip, to another place where they're not known. The other place where they're not known might well be a town. You know, 1851, the census shows us for the first time ever that more people are living in towns than in the countryside. There's the possibility of people merging into the urban mass. So you don't know who they are. You know, these are not settled village communities. So you might not know who the man living next door to you is and what he's done. So there are a couple of things about, if you like, the sociology of the time. But there are very important things happening also in the criminal justice system. One of the things is that prison is becoming the major form of punishment for crime at this period. I think there's a tendency today to think, oh, well, isn't that always been the case? But it hasn't. And so the death penalty earlier in the century was much more common, over 200 offences punishable by death in 1820.
Wow.
And five by 1863. So that's changed. Transportation, I think we might talk about transportation in a bit, but transportation declines and goes. Now, what does this mean? It means that instead of getting rid of criminals, particularly serious criminals, by executing them or sending them away, you actually release them from prison back into the community. And in the late 1850s, and in particular in the early 1860s, there is a big scare about what are called ticket of leave men. Again, we might explain that later on. People at the end of their sentence being allowed out and the amount of crime that they were doing. So along with this, there's a very important move to make crime and punishment a national rather than local concern. So police after 1856, all counties had to have a police force. Before that, that was up to the county. And so you're trying to bring those police forces together to make a kind of national network of information. And these photographs that we're looking at, which are held by the police, are part of that idea that you would send out to other people pictures of your criminals and get from them pictures of theirs so you could keep a degree of surveillance on them. Surveillance which was also carried on by making them report to police stations. But these then, the hope for photography is that in effect you can keep an eye on everybody from a distance because you can send their images around the country. So it's a bit long-winded, but that's what I think it's all about.
No, thanks, Richard. That was really useful to hear a bit more about the context. I thought we could have a look at some of the individuals that are recorded within these books. And the first one I wanted to have a look at, it's an interesting one because it actually includes two individuals with one entry. And I believe they also have their individual entries as well as their joint one, but we'll be looking at their joint entry right now. And that's Owen Pritchard and Daniel Ryan, who I guess could be considered a sort of criminal double act in a way.
Yes, indeed.
Walton Borough Jail, Liverpool. Owen Pritchard and Daniel Ryan. As taken when apprehended at Liverpool in the Walton Borough Jail, previous to this conviction, and sentenced to 5 years penal servitude at Ruthin, 25th of March, 1861. Both of them receiving His Majesty's license to be at large in 1865, after which they were apprehended and convicted at the Carmarthen Assizes, 3rd of March, 1865, and each sentenced to 15 years transportation for burglary.
So yes, a lot of information in that entry, as I think quite a lot of the entries are quite concise and include lots of detail. The one thing I just wanted to kind of delve into was the reference to transportation.
Can't tell you how pleased I was when you chose these two, Pritchard and Ryan, because I know them. I know them very well. I don't know them actually particularly well from Ruthin, but I know them very well from their later criminal career. So they're familiar to me, and I've seen photographs of them in another jail, in one of them in two other jails. Really interesting points there. First, couple of things to hark back to what I was saying earlier. Note that this has come from Walton Jail. So it's been sent from Walton to Ruthin.
Yes.
That's part of, you know, these people, their image goes along so that you can recognize them. Second thing, you noticed that there was reference to them being sentenced and released on licensed. These are the ticket of leave men. These are the people that all the scare is about. These people who've been given a long sentence and then they're out and they're doing it again. And society is very nervous about them. The third thing you pick up on, and very right to pick up on it, is they were sentenced to transportation. In fact, they weren't. This is just a little precautionary word that you have to be a little bit careful when you're using manuscript documents, because people write down their understanding and their understanding is not always exact. The sentence of transportation had been abolished by then. It was abolished by an act in 1857 called the Penal Servitude Act. And so these people were actually sentenced at Carmarthen to periods of penal servitude. Now, I should say that you could still, in certain cases, be transported after 1857, even though you were sentenced to penal servitude. Last boat didn't sail until 1867, a decade later. But generally, you wouldn't be. You would serve penal servitude. And again, we might come on to that later on. These two didn't go abroad, as far as I know. And I've checked the transportation records and there's no sign of them going anywhere, although, you know, it would technically still have been possible. So there's an error there. They were actually sentenced to penal servitude, but I know them. I know them only too well. One of them, Pritchard, was actually a man who had been born in Denbighshire, born in Ruthin. The other one was a South Walian. Both of them had been in trouble in Ruthin before. Now, I'm not getting this from your records, actually. I'm getting this from Carmarthenshire, which is a prison and a criminal justice system, which I spend a lot of time studying. And I've got their full records in that because I've got their prison records rather than the police record, which you've got. So that's interesting because there are two different sorts of photograph and record. But yeah, both of them used aliases. That's the problem. Both of them. Owen Pritchard called himself Charles Williams. Daniel Ryan called himself William Davis. And actually, Owen Pritchard also called himself William Davis on occasion. So not only did they share a criminal career, they shared an alias for some time as well.
Police had their hands full with these two, I think.
They certainly did. Actually, Pritchard had escaped from Ruthin twice and from Carmarthen once, previous to appearing in your book. They're really, really interesting characters. But this shows how, by moving records around the country, you could pick up on somebody's past. They both describe their occupation as bell hanger, which, again, is a bit shady. It means you can move about without any tools. Like if you said you're a carpenter, or you might have to have a box of tools or something. But say you're a bell hanger, if you've found with any tools at all, maybe a large knotted rope and a ladder, you can just say, oh, this is what I use for my job. So we know a lot about these characters, and they're very interesting. And I'm really pleased that we've kicked off with them.
Yeah, definitely a good way to start, I think. So if, say, they were actually sentenced to transportation, if it was 10 years earlier and they were to be sent away, how common was that?
It had been a hugely important sentence. It has actually quite a long sort of prehistory when it was used occasionally. But it's in the 18th century, it becomes a really significant way of getting rid of criminals and populating the colonies, providing a labour force to work in the colonies. So transportation, everybody thinks of Australia. It started in America. We started transporting people to Virginia and places like that to work on the tobacco plantations. But then in 1776, of course, the Americans declared independence. They didn't want our prisoners there. So after a pause, we started sending them out to Australia. And we kept doing that, but gradually Australia didn't want them either because it was building up a law-abiding population. It had its own cities, its own crime. And by the end, by 1857, as I say, there's this kind of residual trickle, but the only places that you could send them to were Western Australia, which was very sort of still underdeveloped. Although I don't think the Western Australians particularly wanted them, but I'm not so sure about that. But there were also a hulk in Bermuda and one in Gibraltar, and hulks were prison ships. So actually, it sounds great to say, oh, sending them off to Australia and Bermuda and Gibraltar. It sounds like a travel agency. I can assure you it certainly was.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Shall we move on to our next?
Yes, who have we got coming up?
So I thought we could look at the extract for John Powell.
Woking Prison number 5550. John Powell, page number 4189, age 25. Committed at Wrexham on the 17th of July 1869 for shopbreaking and larceny. Convicted at Ruthin the 2nd of August 1869. Sentence, 5 years penal servitude. Complexion fair, hair light brown, eyes grey, height 5 feet 6 inches. Marks, thumb and forefinger only on right hand, 2 scars on right side. Date of discharge, 5th of September 1873. Destination, Wrexham.
A very striking photo, isn't it, that one of him with his really missing is. Bits of his hand. Yes, I remember him very well,
So similar to the last entry we had, there's a lot of information included, but also it includes physical description or details of physical description. So why did they record such detail when it came to their height, complexion, it even covers marks?
I mean, there's a very curious thing about this, isn't there? You know, because actually we know more about him because he broke the law than we would ever know if he had a brother who was law abiding. Because Victorian bureaucracy is so great that it wants to know everything about people. So it takes down all the details it can get and affixes the photograph. And there, somebody who probably would never have been photographed in their life at this time, we've got their image, but we've also got all this personal detail. Now, personal details like distinguishing marks, tattoos are another thing that we find discussed. They're the kind of physical things you can't change, really. Obviously, you couldn't change the state of his hand or whatever. You can change your face a little bit. You can cross your eyes when you're being photographed. You can puff your cheeks out. And there are examples of
that. Yes, there are.
Yeah, yes. You've seen them. There's one lovely bloke blowing his cheeks out. And growing a beard or shaving a beard off. You know, too, we were talking of Pritchard and Ryan for the last example. They are very difficult to make out from their faces in the photographs in Carmarthen Jail. So what you want to do is you want to record everything, their height, their eye colour, hair colour, all of these different things, so that you've got more. The man in front of you is somebody who isn't just somebody who's calling himself Jones and says he comes from Swansea when he's never been to Swansea. You've got all this detail that you can match up between the person in front of you and the record that somebody else has got, because they too will take the records of his distinguishing marks. In a lot of these photos, not of him, although they've positioned him so you can see his hand, haven't they? You know, but in a lot of them, they hold their hands up in front of them to the camera to show if they got missing fingers, not at all uncommon, and also to show if they got tattoos, visible tattoos. So you record all these things. And actually, in London, in the Habitual Criminals Register, which was set up in 1869, they still keep absolutely all the distinguishing physical features written down, their height and everything, you know, because it's kind of, it's the narrative that the body gives you, not just the image, and both of them are important.
It's really interesting. And you know, a lot of the criminals in our books have fingers and body parts missing. In your research that you've done over the years, is it quite common for
criminals? It is. I think the thing is, you know, a lot of labourers were working with dangerous equipment, scythes and mowers and things like this. And factory workers were using unguarded machinery, and you would have injuries. And of course, the state of medicine at the time means that, you know, often you would amputate, whereas today you would be able to save a limb or a part of a limb or a finger. But then the safest thing to do to avoid infection is snip it off.
Of course.
Interesting too, Katie. Think about the height. You know,
The height, definitely, yeah.
How tall was he?
So 5'6".
Yeah. Do you think he's quite short, wouldn't you, really?
Yeah, I guess by today's standards.
By today's standards, but he isn't. Not by the standards of the 19th century. My own work, which I did again in Carmarthen, And I looked at the height of the adult male prisoners, that's over 16 years old, remanded between 1844 and 1871. So a good long list of entries there. An average height was about between 5 foot four and a half and 5 foot five for a male. For a woman, adult woman, 4 foot 11. So wow. The 19th century is the only time since the medieval period where the average height of people actually declined. Now, of course, it's risen again. Yeah. But in a way, thank goodness for you and for your excellent police books and for the Victorian passion for bureaucracy, we can understand that. We can see that. We wouldn't know it unless somebody had regarded this as an important matter to write down. And I suspect when we take a photograph of of people at a party or something, we don't write down how tall they are.
Very true. It just got me thinking that one of the characters that we're focusing on in our digital stories from the books is George Walters, who was 5 foot 11.
Yes.
An absolute giant.
And you see, if people listening to this, if they live in an old Welsh cottage and they bump their head on the door as they go in and out, and they think to themselves, why didn't they build them with a bigger door? They didn't need to.
No.
That's the answer. You've got plenty of room if you're 5 foot six. But you're right, there are some taller ones. I found a giant Cornishman once who worked on the railway and stole whiskey. He was over 6 foot, you know, but he would have been quite unusual. And of course, what we're talking about here, we're talking about people at the lowest end of the socioeconomic scale. You know, if you had a better diet and didn't work so hard, you probably would have been a bit taller and not have so many bits missing.
No, that's a good point to mention, definitely. So yeah, one last thing I just wanted to touch upon with John Power was penal servitude.
Oh yes.
So you mentioned that briefly before when we were talking about transportation. But yeah, I just thought if you could tell us a bit more about exactly what it means, because I don't particularly know the exact definition. So yeah, it's useful to know.
It's a very interesting thing, because in a way, it's servitude is a bit like slavery, you know, in the common meaning of it, and penal is punitive slavery, sort of. So what it means technically, let me explain that. Penal servitude was introduced as an alternative to, and indeed actually a replacement for, transportation. But the idea of penal servitude was that it involved very hard labour. Now, many prisons, well, all prisons by this time, are using hard labour sentences for a lot of offenders. And that would be in the case of males. I think we'll talk about females maybe later on. But in the case of males, that would generally be a treadwheel or stone breaking. But penal servitude then was harder labour, and it was public labour. It was public associated labour, and it was working on dockyards, and it was breaking stones on huge stones for road building. And it was in three stages. The first stage, which was this time a 9 month spell in solitary confinement, which was particularly difficult for people who generally, you know, they might not even have their own bed. They'd have to share it in a lodging house or at home. And there they were actually cut off from the rest of the world in solitary confinement. They do 9 months there, and then part of their sentence, the longest part of their sentence, on this public works convict labour. You often see, you know, in old films, images of people with a broad arrow on their uniforms, breaking up stones out on Dartmoor or wherever, you know.
Yeah.
Though it's that kind of hard physical labour. And then they would be released on licence. That's a ticket of leave. Yeah. That's what we've seen happening in these cases. So it's a particularly gruelling, I mean, to some extent, excessively so. People would mutilate themselves to avoid having to go and do the work. You know, I've come across cases of people putting their hands on the railway track so that they wouldn't have to do it, taking all kinds of dangerous substances or whatever. I mean, it was really, really different. All a bit grim. I don't want to go into all the details, but it's really, really heavy labour as an alternative to the labour they would have done in Australia, for example, if they'd been transported.
Okay.
And don't forget, as I've said, you might be doing ordinary hard labour if you weren't doing penal servitude. So it's a step up from already things which could be quite gruelling.
Okay, so shall we next have a look at a entry for a woman? So we've looked so far just at men within these books, but there are a few women, and one of these is Mary Wilson.
Copy of letter to J. Bradshaw, Esquire, Deputy Chief Constable of Denbighshire, County Prison, Cardigan, 24th of January, 1872. Dear Sir, enclosed, I send you a photo of Mary Wilson, alias Knight, whose description is on page 4 of the Police Gazette of the 19th instant. She was released from here on the 17th instant, after 15 calendar months of hard labour for shopbreaking. Her husband, Samuel Wilson, is in Montgomery Prison for trial for burglary. And another man, also, she says, her husband, John Knight, is now undergoing penal servitude. She speaks of Ruthin and Wrexham as her home. And because she is such a thorough bad lot, I send you the enclosed in the full belief she will be in trouble again for long. She has been formally committed and sentenced to 9 calendar months hard labour here for felony. On both occasions, was at times one of the most refractory prisoners it has been my lot to deal with. Yours faithfully, M. Elliot, Governor. Note, well known in Dalgellau, see letter on file.
A really interesting entry, that one.
I think people are going to think that we've colluded on this more than we have, you know, because again, I was delighted to see Mary turn up in your list of people that you'd chosen to talk about, because she's a bit of a character. She also, that photograph of her is also actually the only surviving photograph of the inside of Cardigan Jail, because just like the two other cases we've discussed, you'll notice that these are photographs which have been sent in from other places. Well, a second man may have been re-photographed in Ruthin, that's fair, but he had been originally photographed when he was in jail, so they may have had a copy from that. But as I say, she was in Cardigan Jail, and again, the reference, her husband, was serving PS, penal servitude, the second one again. There's much there, and that she had been circulated in the Police Gazette. And that, again, you see, this is part of that network of communication. Police Gazette would go out to every police force, so everybody would see it. But our governor down here in Cardiganshire, he's not satisfied with the Police Gazette. He knows Mary. He knows what a difficult refractory, is his word. Very 90s century word. What a pain in the bum she is, frankly. And so he sends a special letter and a photograph. He's saying, isn't he, in a sense, she's coming your way, you know, we think she might be making for you. And so it's really interesting. There she is in, you know, in the book, and she served a hard labour sentence already. Yes. Not penal servitude. This is just one of the ordinary hard labour sentences that she would have got for an offence like the one she's committed here. Hard labour for women was rather different from hard labour for men. In the 1820s, when the treadwheel was first introduced into prison, women were put on the treadwheel as well as men. But that was soon stopped because of internal injuries that they were found to suffer from the treadwheel, in particular prolapses. And so women were taken off that. And instead, they were set generally, it might differ from place to place, to tasks like laundry, which they generally did. And you think, well, laundry, you know, that's hardly hard labour. But we had no washing machines then. carrying all the laundry, you know, all the various sheets and uniforms when they're soaking wet and heavy, and then having to wash them by hand. And that's hard labour. They might be doing cookery, but cooking for the prison, but I don't think we ought to assume that they did that. They certainly did in some prisons, but I come across male cooks in prison, so it's not universal in prison with women. Now, so what was prison like for women? Well, the major sort of hard labour that she would do would be oakum picking, and oakum is ship's rope. And you would be given a certain amount of rope, old ship's rope covered in tar, horrible stuff, and you would pick it apart with your hands, or sometimes, if you could get one, with a nail. If you went into a Victorian prison, I still do it when I go in, you run your hand over the cell door in the ventilator. If somebody's found a nail somewhere, they would hide it there for the next prisoner, because it was really useful for taking it in and digging away into the rope to make it into its little filaments. So it was old ship rope, you buy it in, hence the expression we still use, money for old rope. You buy it in, you pick it apart, get the prisoners to pick it apart. It splits their fingers. It's horrible, covers them in oil. And then you sell it back to shipbuilders for them to soak it in tar and cork the seams of wooden-built boats. You jam it between the planks to make it water. So it was a horrible job, but that was mostly what women would do in hard labour. And of course, another thing, you will know this from the Rhythm experience as well. In the 19th century, it was regarded as essential that women were kept separate from men in jails. Yes. And that hadn't always been the case. Actually, 18th century, you could have men and women mingling in the same areas, but they had to be kept apart. So she wouldn't have enjoyed that. The other thing, too, of course, makes us smile, isn't it, is what he says about her husband and then her other husband.
Yes.
And that is genuinely, it is quite funny, actually, isn't it? She's got apparently two husbands, one definite and one he's not so sure about, but somebody's told him. And they're both in prison. But till 1856, and even after 1856, divorce was absolutely prohibitively expensive. Even after 1856, when the Matrimonial Causes Act changed the process, I mean, there's not a great incentive amongst a lot of people who didn't have any funds to go to the trouble of getting a divorce. So, you know, if you leave somebody and you live apart from them for ages, then, yeah, you might get married again. I don't think we should be hugely surprised about that, because we're still in a time when we've talked about the desire of government to introduce more uniformity, which it does by things like registering births, marriages and deaths, you know that. Yeah. So it becomes an administrative necessity to do these things. But out in the wilds, somewhere near Rhythm or Cardigan or Montgomery or wherever she happened to meet these chaps, she might just get married because, you know, that's what you do. Yeah. Who wants to go to the divorce court?
Exactly, yeah. Sounds more sharp than what she was.
Yeah, I like her.
And it's the fact that it's a transcribed letter rather than taking the same format as the other entries.
Interesting entry, yeah.
And how notorious that Elliot, he took it upon himself to make sure that word got out about her. So we've kind of seen from our discussions in this episode about how much can be explored just from one document or one record. Do you think this shows how valuable archives can be to kind of uncover stories and delve into our past?
Absolutely. I mean, I've really enjoyed looking at these records myself, but I think there's a danger sometimes people will think, yeah, but history belongs to somebody else. You know, it's a specialist. It's the bloke who's jabbering on about penal servitude and the people on the telly in the white gloves and all the rest of it. History's for other people, and it really, really isn't. Public records are there for the public, not for professional historians. They're there for all of us. And I think what's really important that I would like to say, having benefited from talking to so many people who just want to get in there and learn things for themselves, is that I would urge people to be aware of the kind of richness of the tapestry of the past, which you can get not just in specialist repositories like the National Library of Wales or the public records in Kew in London. They're there. They're in your county. It's free. It is free, isn't it? Yeah, it's free.
Yes.
You can go in. Don't be frightened, because nice people like Katie, who's been very nice to me, will help you to find what you want. A lot of people, it seems to me, go into archives and they're interested in the history of their house or the history of their family. And that's fine. That's fine. I'm all in favour of it. But for me, I always think there's something else that people can do rather than just compiling a list of this was my great grandfather and this was his grandfather and all the rest of it, and just taking things back as a list. Sometimes you can step off that ladder and say to yourself, hold on, well, he worked in this place. I wonder what it was like working there. I wonder how big the town was when he was doing this. I wonder who else lived near him. In other words, you can make your exploration not just linear, but actually contextual. There, a couple of rather technical phrases there. But you know what I mean? There's so much richness in the archives. I'd urge everybody to go and have a look. I really would. Go and have a look at something, because the thrill, the absolute thrill, I've been an academic for 45 years, but the thrill that I had this morning when I was looking at a particular document in another archive, a document which nobody had looked at since 1805, and the thrill that I got from holding that in my hand is undiminished from the first time I did it. And that's a thrill that everybody can have. Not just a professional, everybody. So I'd urge anybody listening to this, make contact with your local record office. Most of them have got loads of good stuff online.
Very
but
true.
Don't stop online. Looking online is like seeing an animal in a cage. Go and see them in their surroundings, their natural surroundings. Go and handle the documents. Go and see Katie. Go and see her colleagues. And I mean this. They're not paying me to say this. You know, just go and see them and just enjoy, revel in the past. It's not something that's just on telly.
Thank you so much, Richard, for chatting with me today and sharing some of your knowledge about our criminal description books. It's been really interesting to learn more about them and explore the lives of some of the individuals that are recorded within the books as well. So yeah, it's been really great.
Mae ein harchifau'n llawn o storiau. Ewch i'n gwefan i ddarganfod mwy. odriflig.agyddec.cymru. I weld ein straeon digidol, chwiliwch amdanom ar YouTube.